This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Brian's Return by Gary Paulson. Chapter 1. Brian sat quietly, taken by a peace he had not known for a long time, and let the canoe drift forward along the lily pads. To his right was the shoreline of a small lake he had flown into an hour earlier. Around him was the lake itself, an almost circular body of water approximately 80 acres, surrounded by northern forest, pine, spruce, poplar and birch, and thick brush. It was late spring, June 3rd to be exact, and the lake was teeming, crawling, buzzing, and flying with life. Mosquitoes and flies filled the air, swarming on him, and he smiled now, remembering his first horror at the small blood drinkers. In the middle of the canoe he had an old coffee can with some kindling inside it, and a bit of birch bark, and he lit them and dropped a handful of green poplar leaves on the tiny fire. Soon smoke billowed out and drifted back and forth across the canoe, and the insects left him. He had repellent with him this time, along with nearly 200 pounds of other gear, but he hated the smell of it, and found it didn't work as well as a touch of smoke now and then. The black flies and deer flies and horse flies ignored repellent completely. He swore they seemed to lick it off, but they hated the smoke and stayed well off the canoe. The relief gave him time to see the rest of the activity on the lake. He remained still, watching, listening. To his left rear, he heard a beaver slap the water with its tail and dive, a warning at the intruder, at the strange, smoking log holding the person. Brian smiled. He had come to know beaver for what they truly were, engineers, family-oriented home builders. He'd read that most of the cities in Europe were founded by beaver, that beaver had first felled the trees along the rivers and dammed them up. The rising water killed more trees, and when the food was gone and the beaver had no more bark to chew, they left. The dams eventually broke apart, and the water drained and left large clearings along the rivers where the beaver had cut down all the trees. Early man came along and started cities where the clearings lay. Cities like London and Paris were founded and settled first by beaver. In front and to the right, he heard the heavier footsteps of a deer moving through the hazel brush. Probably a buck, because he heard no smaller footsteps of a fawn. A buck with its antlers in velvet, more than likely, moving away from the smell of smoke from the canoe. A frog jumped from a lily pad 6 feet away and had barely entered the water when a northern pike took it with a slashing strike that tore the surface of the lake and flipped lily pads over to show their pale undersides. Somewhere a hawk screamed, and he looked for it, but could not see it through the leaves of the trees around the lake. It would be hunting, bringing home mice for a nest full of young, looking for something to kill. No, Brian thought, not in that way. The hawk did not hunt to kill. It hunted to eat. Of course it had to kill to eat, along with all other carnivorous animals. But the killing was the means to bring food, not the end. Only man hunted for sport or for trophies. It is the same with me as with the hawk, Brian felt. He turned the paddle edgeways, eased it forward silently, and pulled back with an even stroke. I will kill to eat or to defend myself, but for no other reason. In the past 2 years, except for the time with Derek on the river, in a kind of lonely agony, he had tried to find things to read or watch that brought the woods to him. He missed the forest, the lakes, the wild as he thought of it, so much that at times he could not bear it. The guns and hunting magazines, the hunting and fishing videos on television sickened him. Men using high-velocity weapons to shoot deer or elk from so far away they could barely see them, or worse, blasting them from a blind or the back of a jeep, baiting bear with pits full of rotten meat and shooting them with rifles that could stop a car, taking bass for sport or money in huge contests with fancy boats and electronic gear that located each fish individually. Sport, they called it. But they weren't hunting or fishing because they needed to. They were killing to kill, not eat, to prove some kind of worth, and he stopped reading the magazines and watching the videos. His survival in the wilderness had made him famous in a small way, and some of the magazines interviewed him, as did some of the hunting and sporting shows on television. But they got it all wrong, completely wrong. "Boy conquers savage wilderness," some magazines said in the blurbs on the covers. "Learns to beat nature." It wasn't that way, had never been that way. Brian hadn't conquered anything. Nature had whipped him, not the other way around, had beaten him down and pounded the stupidity out of his brain until he had been forced to bend, forced to give, forced to learn to survive. He had learned the most important fact of all, and the one that is so hard for many to understand or believe. Man proposes. Nature disposes. He hadn't conquered nature at all. He had become part of it. And it had become part of him. Maybe all of him. And that, he thought as the canoe slid gently forward, had been exactly the problem. Chapter 2. If he had to name the final straw that had done it, that had driven him away, driven him back, it would, he thought, have had to be the noise. Another stroke of the paddle and the canoe slithered along the water. It was a beautiful canoe, named the Raft, made of Kevlar, 16 feet long and weighing only 52 pounds empty, as smooth as fish skin. It seemed to fit nature as well as wind or water, seemed almost alive. He had tried. He had tried as hard as he could to fit in, to become normal again. After the fame wore off, the novelty of telling people what had happened, showing them how he'd made the first fire, how to make a bow, how to hunt, when all that was done, and the world around him had returned to a semblance of normalcy, he'd tried to fit back in. For a year and more, he had acted, in his mind anyway, as if he were normal. School. He'd gone back to school and tried to become reacquainted with old friends. They were still friends, glad to welcome him back into their company. The problem wasn't them. It was him. "Let's go down to the mall and play some video games," they would say, "or play softball, or ride bicycles, or. And he would try. But sports and shooting electronic bullets or rays at imaginary enemies that clomped across screens seemed silly, pale in comparison to what his real life had been like, having moose attack him, living on the edge of starving, living only because his thinking, his brain, kept him alive. He couldn't get into the games, couldn't believe in them. It was the same with the people who made up extreme sports just to prove they could do it. Rock climbers, radical skateboarders, wilderness programs that were supposed to toughen up city kids, rich kids, and make them better people. All games. He drifted away, talking about which girl liked which boy, or who was cool and who was not, or who would be at what party, or who was not doing drugs. All of it became a swirl around him. He heard the sounds, nodded, tried to appear interested, but in the end, sitting alone in his room one evening, he realized that he couldn't care less about any of it. He sought solitude. Even when he was in a group, nodding and smiling and talking, he was alone in his mind. Sometimes his thinking would catch up with the reality of what was happening, and he would see himself talking as if in the third person. "Here is Brian," he would think, "telling Bill that he can't go to the movie tonight because..." Reality began to slip away from him. Not that he was mentally different or mentally ill, so much as that it just bored him. There was a small park in town, a stand of trees with some hedges, and he found himself going there more and more, walking past the park on his way home from school, stopping under the trees, closing his eyes, remembering the woods, the wind, the movement of leaves, the world without the incessant noise. Not just cars and horns and sirens and television, which he had come to hate because it took so much away from his thinking, but people talking and planes flying over, doors slamming. It all rolled into one kind of static sound, one noise. It came to a head in, of all places, the front entryway of Mackey's Pizza Den. Brian had become aloof, sometimes unaware of the social life around him, and without knowing it, had upset a boy named Carl Lammers. Carl was a football player, a large boy. His nickname was Hulk, and also a bully who envied Brian's celebrity. Brian didn't know him. Apparently, Carl thought Brian had said something bad about him, and he was coming out of Mackey's Pizza Den just as Brian was walking in with a boy and girl from school. The boy was small and thin. He was named Haley, and the girl was named Susan, and she thought Brian was great and wanted to know him better, and had invited him for a pizza so she could talk to him. Haley had been standing nearby and thought the invitation included him, to Susan's disappointment. Carl had asked Susan on a date once, and she had refused him. Seeing her with Brian made his anger that much worse. He saw Brian through the glass of the door, saw him walking with Susan, and Carl threw his whole weight into his shoulder and slammed the door open, trying to knock Brian off balance. It all went wrong. Brian was too far to the side, and the door missed him. It caught Haley full on, smashing his nose. Blood poured out immediately and slammed him back into Susan. The two of them went flying backward, and Susan fell to the ground beneath Haley and twisted her kneecap. "Oh," she moaned. For a moment, everything seemed to hang in place. The door was open, Carl standing there and Brian off to the side, his face perplexed. He had been thinking about the woods when it happened. And Susan and Haley on the ground, blood all over Haley's face, and Susan moaning, holding her knee. "What?" Brian turned back to Carl just as Carl took a swing at his head. Had it connected fully, Brian thought, it would have torn his head off. Dodging before it caught him, he missed the total force of the blow, but even then it struck his shoulder and knocked him slightly back and down on one knee. Then things came very quickly. Haley was blinded by the blood in his eyes, but Susan saw it all and still didn't believe it. "Something happened," she said later. "Something happened to Brian. Carl just disappeared." In that instant, Brian totally reverted. He was no longer a boy walking into a pizza parlor. He was Brian back in the woods. Brian with the moose. Brian being attacked. Brian living because he was quick and focused and intense on staying alive. And Carl was the threat, the thing that had to be stopped, attacked, destroyed. Brian came off the ground like a spring. His eyes, his mind, searched for a weapon. Something, anything that he could use, but there was nothing. Pavement, a brick wall, a glass door. Nothing loose, it didn't matter. The thought did not slow his movement, and he had himself. He had his hands. He did not box. Nothing in nature boxed, hit with closed fists. Instead, he kept his hands open and jabbed with the thick heels of his palms, slamming them forward in short blows that, taken singly, might not have done much damage. But he did not hit once or twice. He smashed again and again, striking like a snake, the blows multiplying their force. Carl played football, and physical contact was part of it. He actually enjoyed the shock of blocking, tackling. But this was insane. He felt as if he were being struck all over at the same time. Brian hid his eyes, slamming them again and again until Carl couldn't see and reeled back against the wall, his hands up to cover his face. He tried to quit. "All right." Brian was past hearing Carl. He was past anything. He was in a place where normal rules didn't apply. Carl was temporarily blinded, but he was far from finished in Brian's mind. With Carl's face covered, his stomach was open, and Brian struck there, pleased to find he was overweight and soft. A place to aim, a place to hurt. He hit again and again, still using the heels of his hands, his wrists rigid, the blows up and into the top of the stomach, forcing air out of the diaphragm so it whistled from Carl's nostrils. Carl's hands dropped to cover his stomach, and Brian went for his face again, pounded the eyes so they were swollen shut, blow on blow, until Carl's hands came up again. When Carl crouched, tried to protect everything and left the back of his head open, Brian took him there, clubbing down with both hands joined, pounding until Carl was on his hands and knees, his nose bleeding, the air wheezing from his lungs. "It can't get up," Brian thought, surprised how cool he was. He wasn't angry. I can't let it get up or it will hurt me, he thought. At first he didn't realize that he was thinking it and not him. It has to stay down. I have to keep it down. Carl was on the edge of being senseless. But something, perhaps the training of football, would not let him collapse completely. It would have been better if he had. Brian couldn't stop. He kept clubbing down, working silently, crouched on his knees now, bringing his joined hands in a double fist again and again onto the back of Carl's head as if he were cutting wood. Somebody was screaming, and other people were running toward them, clawing at Brian, pulling him up and away, but he kept working at it, centered, focused on clubbing Carl down even as they pulled him off. They would pull him away for a moment, and he would tear loose and attack again. Don't let it up, he said. I have to keep it down. Chapter 3 Police came to the pizza place. They called an ambulance and took Carl to the hospital, where it was found that the skin around his eyes was severely bruised, as were his ribs and his stomach. Though it was not really necessary, they kept him in the hospital overnight for observation, which made his condition seem much more severe than it was. The police handcuffed Brian and put him in the back seat of the car while they interviewed witnesses. Susan came to the car, but the police pulled her away. No talking, they told her. No talking to the boy. But he didn't do anything wrong. Carl attacked him. Brian was just no talking to the boy. In a short time, the police came back and removed the handcuffs, but they wouldn't let Brian go. Instead, they drove him home, and he had the unpleasant experience of having police with him when his mother opened the door. She was thin and dressed for work in her real estate blazer. Brian, what? There was a fight at Mackey's Pizza. Your boy was beating up on another boy. Brian, is that true? Brian said nothing. Brian, is that true? She repeated. Were you fighting? He looked at his mother. He thought briefly of trying to tell her the truth, that it hadn't been the Brian she knew, but a different one, a totally different person, that it hadn't been a fight, but an automatic reaction. It hadn't happened because it hadn't been him. It had been some kind of animal, a boy animal. No, an animal boy. I am animal boy, he thought, and tried not to smile. It is most definitely not funny. He shook his head. I know. I didn't mean it's funny. I don't know exactly what happened. Did you fight, like the policeman says? He thought a moment. I was reacting, protecting myself. The boy was beaten senseless, the policeman said. He didn't know his name. He attacked me. We were told several versions, the policeman said to Brian's mother. Apparently they were fighting over a girl. A girl? She looked at Brian. You have a girl? Brian shook his head. No, it wasn't that way at all. I was coming in the door, and he slammed the door open, and Susan was knocked down, and he hit me, and I... But they didn't hear him. Even if they had listened, they wouldn't have heard him. Not really. They would never understand him. So he shrugged and played dumb and let them think what they wanted. It didn't matter, because he was starting to understand it now, was starting to see what had to happen, what he needed to do. I know someone, a counselor, the policeman said. He's a retired cop and works with boys. I'll give you his name. The policeman took out a notebook and wrote a name and number on a page, tore it out and gave it to Brian's mother. Here, call him, and he can talk to your boy. Animal boy, thought Brian. Not boy, animal boy. But he didn't smile. Maybe he can straighten him out. Not unless he can see into my heart, Brian thought. Chapter 4 The sign was hung on the side of an office attached to a house. Caleb Lancaster, Family Counseling. Please come in. It wasn't really an office as much as it was a room stuck on the corner of a two-car garage. It had probably been a workshop, Brian thought. He stopped at the door. This cop retired and is making money on the side by counseling boys in his old workshop. Great. Just great. He'll tell me to get good grades, don't fight, don't do drugs, obey my parents and the police, and send me on my way. After getting a check from Mom, which is really a check from the money I've saved since Mom doesn't have any money. Great. He had talked to a counselor briefly the first year after he'd come back, but there hadn't really been anything wrong then. He hadn't started to miss the woods as much as he would later. And football players hadn't attacked him yet either, he thought, looking at the sign. For a moment he played with the idea of turning and leaving. This was so stupid. There was nothing wrong with him. He had come back at somebody who was attacking him. He had come back a little hard, maybe, but just the same. His hand turned the knob without his really meaning it to, and the door opened. "Hello. You must be Brian." Brian stopped just inside the door, and his eyes moved, and in 2 seconds he had taken in everything in the room. Plain white walls, some cheap pictures of woods and mountains that didn't seem to match the rest of the space, a framed document of some kind. The desk was gray-green metal. There was one chair facing the front of the desk, an old iron office chair. Along one wall was a gray-green metal bookcase, filled with books so heavy the shelves sagged. The floor was clean gray concrete. It was maybe the ugliest room he had ever seen. Behind the desk sat what Brian could only think of as a wall of a man. He wasn't fat, just enormous, and richly black, with a smile that grew wider as he stood and held out his hand. Brian almost moved back. This man had to be nearly 7 feet tall. He literally almost filled the room. "I'm Caleb." Brian took his hand and felt himself being moved toward the chair across from Caleb. "Take a seat. Any seat," he laughed. "As long as it's this one." Brian sat, waited. "They tell me you're the boy who lived in the woods, the one who was all over television a couple years ago." Brian nodded. "Is that right?" Brian nodded again and realized with a start that Caleb was blind. "Yes." Caleb laughed, deep and booming. "You were nodding." "Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't know." "Don't be sorry. It's flattering that you took so long to see it. Did it happen when you were a cop?" Another laugh. "Not really. I got a headache one day, a really fierce one while I was working, and 3 days later I was blind."
"Just like that?"
"Just like that. The doctors had some fancy names for what happened, but I like to keep things simple. I had a headache, I went blind, that's it. But we're not supposed to talk about me. We're supposed to talk about why you beat the hell out of that football player."
Brian leaned back.
"If you want to." Brian took a breath. "Or we could talk about something else."
"I didn't beat the hell out of him."
"They took him to the hospital."
"He attacked me."
"Over a girl," Caleb said.
"No. Or maybe, I don't know. He just slammed out the door and hit me."
"And you hit him back?"
Brian nodded, then remembered. "Yes."
"Tell me about the woods."
"Pardon?"
"The woods. Tell me about them. I'm a city boy and don't know anything about woods. What are they like?"
"I..." Brian shrugged. "They're all right."
"All right? That's all? After all you did, that's all you can say. I heard you had to eat bugs and almost died. What was it like? Really, like?"
Brian paused, remembering. A blade of grass that moved. The way a rabbit turned its head just before an arrow hit it. A flash of color when a fish rolled in the water. "I don't think you would understand. Nobody who hasn't been there can really know."
Caleb nodded and was silent. Then he spoke softly. "Tell me one thing, then."
"What do you mean?"
"Tell me one thing. One part of it that I can see in my mind and understand. You can do that, can't you?"
Brian shrugged. "I guess so. Which part do you want to know about?"
"You pick it."
Brian thought for nearly a full minute. Moose attacks, wild wind, good kills, near misses, food. Lord, food when he was starving, and the fierce joy that came when a hunt worked. All of it was there, every little and big thing that had happened to him in a summer and a winter. And in the end, he decided to tell Caleb about a sunset. There had been many sunsets, and they were all beautiful. Every one had had different light, different sounds. And he remembered them all, the way somebody who watches a wonderful movie can remember every bit of the movie. The one he described for Caleb was in the winter. It had been a still, unbelievably cold day when trees exploded, and the sky was so brilliantly clear that when he looked into the blue, it didn't seem to have a limit,
didn't seem to end. It was late afternoon, and he had eaten hot food inside his shelter and gone outside to get wood in for the night. The sun was below the tree line, but there was still light, and the sky was rapidly turning a deep cobalt blue, and Brian could see a single bright star, or was it a planet? Venus, perhaps, near where the sun had disappeared. Suddenly, and it was so quick he almost missed it, a spear of golden light shot from the sun and seemed to pierce the star. Like an arrow of gold light, one brilliant shaft there and gone. And while he watched, transfixed, another shaft came, and then another. Three times, three light arrows from the sun shot through the star. It made him believe, made him know, that there was something bigger than he was. Something bigger than everybody, bigger than all. He thought it must mean something, had to mean something, but he could not think what. Three arrows of light. Three arrow. Maybe a name. Maybe a direction. Later, after he came back and was trying to understand all that had happened, he read that early Inuits in the north saw the northern lights and believed them to be the souls of dead children dancing. Brian knew it was really the ionosphere ionizing, but he still wanted it to be the souls of dead children playing, wanted it to mean more, and it was the same with this sunset. It was so beautiful it took his breath, and he stood, his arms full of wood, staring at the sky until the sun, the star, and the light were gone, wanting it all to mean more. He tried to tell Caleb everything about the sunset, every color, every shade, the small sounds of the ice cracks singing on the lake, the hiss of the cold sky, the rustle of powder snow settling. Told it all, and when he was done, he looked across the desk and saw that Caleb was crying. Chapter 5. Did I say something wrong? Caleb wiped his cheeks with the back of his hand. No, I was just moved by how it must have looked. It sounds so incredibly beautiful. It is. It's everything. Just everything. And you miss it. There it was, out in the open. The thought had been in Brian's mind ever since the police had brought him home, and before that, without his knowing it, small at first, then bigger and bigger, and Caleb had seen it. Yes, more than anything. I miss being there. I feel I should go back. Is it running away or running to? Brian frowned, thinking. It's neither. It's what I am now, for better or worse. It's more that I just can't be with people anymore. You hate people? No, not like that. I don't hate them. I have friends and love some people, my mother and father, and I've tried to do things with people and go to school and be normal. But I can't. It just doesn't work. I've seen too much. They talk about things that don't interest me, and when I talk about what I think about, what I see, they just glaze over. Like the sunset. Brian nodded, then remembered again that Caleb couldn't see. But he'd seen more of Brian than anybody else. That and other things, many other things. Can you tell me some of the other things? Like the sunset? Caleb nodded. If you wish. Whatever you want to tell me. Again, Brian paused, thinking. If it's too private. No, it's not that. It's more that what I've seen is different from how people think things really are. Television makes them see things that aren't real, that don't exist. If I tell you how it really is, you won't believe it. Try me. Brian sighed. All right. Mice have houses and make towns under the snow in the winter. Make towns? See, you don't believe it, do you? Caleb shook his head. I meant that I wanted to know more. Please tell me about it. And so Brian did. He had been moving around a clearing one day on snowshoes, hunting. It was cold, but not the crippling cold that came sometimes. and he had an arrow on the bowstring of his war bow, just in case, when he looked out in the clearing and saw a fox make a high, bounding jump and bury its head in the snow, its tail sticking up like a bottle brush. The fox came up with snow all over its face, looked around. Brian froze and the fox didn't see him, then looked down at the snow again. It cocked its head, listening, then made another leap, fully 4 feet in the air, and dove head first into the snow again. This time it came up with a mouse wriggling in its front teeth. The fox bit down once, killed it, swallowed it, and then listened again, bounced in the air again, and came up with another. The fox did it 8 more times, and got 3 more mice before trotting out of the clearing and away. Brian watched the whole thing, wondered briefly about eating mice, and thought better of it. Not that he was squeamish, but he had a deer by this time and plenty of meat, and besides, it would take probably 30 or 40 mice to make a meal, and cleaning them, gutting each mouse and skinning it, would take a lot of work and time. Still, he was curious. He hadn't thought much about mice, but now that he did, he supposed they would be hibernating. But the ones that came up in the fox's mouth were wriggling. Clearly, they hadn't been sleeping. Brian moved into the clearing and stared at the snow, listening as the fox had done, but he couldn't hear anything. He took off his snowshoes and used one of them as a shovel, carefully scooping away the snow until he was down to grass, and it was here he found the truth. The grass had been tall when winter came. When the snow fell on it, the grass bent over on itself and made a thick, thatch-like roof the snow couldn't penetrate. It was beneath this roof that the mice lived. Brian cleared more of the snow and found small, round tunnels leading from one snug grass room to another, little homes under the snow. In itself, the grass would not have been that warm, but the snow, 2 feet of powder over the top, made a wonderful insulator, and the rooms were dry and cozy-looking. When Brian lay on his stomach and looked down one of the tunnels, he saw that light penetrated the snow, and as he watched, a field mouse came around a corner and saw Brian. It froze and turned and ran back. During the 10 minutes he watched, 5 more mice came down the tunnel and ran back when they saw it was open. A whole city was under there, he thought as he watched, a mouse city. There must have been hundreds of mice down in the grass tunnels and rooms, protected and snug for the winter, except that it wasn't completely safe. The fox knew they were down there, and with those big ears it listened until it heard one moving through a tunnel. Then it leaped in the air and pounced head first, driving down through the snow and grass to catch the mouse. The fox didn't hit all the time, Brian told Caleb, finishing the story. There were probably hundreds he missed living down there, so most of the mice were fine. It made me feel foolish trying to keep my cave warm, working so hard to live. The mice had it all figured. Does anybody else know this? I haven't seen it in books or anywhere, and nobody would believe me if I told them. I believe you. Well, almost nobody. Tell me more. About the mice? About the woods. What time is it?
3:00.
Oh, I have another appointment at 3:30. Why don't you come back tomorrow and talk to me?
As a counselor?
No, there's nothing wrong with you.
There isn't?
Not a thing. In the attack, you were simply defending yourself, the best way you knew how. I just want to hear more about the North Woods. You don't have to come if you don't want to, and tell your mother there's no charge. It's just that you make it sound so real. I want to hear more.
All right.
Brian rose. I'd be glad to come back tomorrow. And he was surprised to find as he walked to the door that he meant it. Chapter 6 At first things didn't go nicely, and he would look back later and wonder at the timing and the way life worked. It was spring, with 2 months of school left. School became difficult for Brian. Everybody knew about the fight. Some thought he was a hero, and some thought he was crazy. And most kept away from him. He ran into Carl Lammers now and then in the hallway, and Lammers stayed well clear of him. Susan decided Brian was just exactly the right person in the whole world for her, and made an effort to be near him whenever she could, walk with him whenever she could, talk to him whenever she could. He knew she was a good person, but she was very popular, a member of all the clubs who did all the activities, and she was always trying to draw Brian out, to make him talk about himself. Finally, he began to avoid her, in as nice a manner as possible, but word went around that he was stuck up, and soon Susan and everybody else left him alone. Though he liked the solitude, oddly it made him feel bad and made going to classes difficult. He began to hate school and went only because he had to. He studied out of habit, and strangely his grades stayed up. Months later he thought that he would have gone crazy except for Caleb and the dream. The dream came when he was awake. In school, at home with his mother, whenever there was a moment of quiet or boredom, his thoughts would glaze over and the dream would come. It was a dream of getting ready, always that, getting ready. Ready to go back, ready to go home. To go home to the woods and find, he didn't know what. To find himself, something about himself. Often the dream would be about what he would take, the kind of weapon. Always a bow, never a gun. The kind of arrows, fishing equipment, clothing. Not just to go back and survive this time, but to live and to be happy where he lived. Just to be. The right kind of equipment. His canoe, a good bow, several dozen good arrows, the right pair of snowshoes, some hooks and line, a good sleeping bag. Tarp to make a shelter, maybe a tent, a pot to cook in, no, two pots, one big and one medium, clothes for fall and winter, good boots, moccasins. He worked the list endlessly in his mind, improving it, changing it, and finally writing it down on the list. He carried it in a notebook wherever he went, making changes as they came to him, meticulously noting each detail of each item. I have become truly anal, he thought once, when he changed the kind of arrowheads from the fancy new razorheads to the old-fashioned MA-3s, three-bladed Army-issue arrowheads that needed sharpening, but were so strong you could hit a rock without hurting them. But it was more than just being picky. In the end, he was keeping his sanity, arranging his life. At first, the list was a guide from the dream to reality, but when he had perfected the list, he started to gather the items on it, ordering from catalogs in the backs of hunting and fishing magazines. His mother knew he was ordering, but she was involved in other things and left him mostly to himself. And as he received items, he put them in his room, and she didn't question him. The first thing to come was a bow. He did not want to get too complicated, and stayed away from the compound bows with wheels and pulleys. They were more accurate, maybe, and far easier to pull, but he sensed they would break with rough use. Instead, he wrote to Blakely, a man who made longbows and shorter recurved bows, and ordered what Blakely called a short longbow. True longbows were fine, but very long, as the name implied, and Brian knew that in the brush they would hang up on branches and be hard to use. He ordered a shorter version, with 45-pound pull at 26 inches. He hadn't been sure of the pull weight, but he told Blakely his size and what he wanted to use it for, general hunting, and Blakely told him to keep it low. Blakely made bows with up to 120 pounds pull, but they were brutal, and he wrote, "If the arrowhead is sharp, it will penetrate from a softer bow as well as a hard one." The bow was beautiful, a mix of ironwood and rosewood laminated in thin strips with fiberglass on the front and back. Blakely included 4 extra strings. He also sold arrows, so Brian bought 100 Port Orford cedar shafts and all the tools and pre-cut feathers and nocks he would need to make his own arrows. Blakely also sent along 50 of the MA-3 broadheads and field points for the arrows so he could practice without using the MA-3s. Brian had never made arrows before, but there were full instructions with the equipment, and Brian found it easy to do. He went to a garden store and brought home 3 hay bales. He put them up in the backyard and put a cardboard target in front. When he had 6 arrows finished, he started shooting each day. It was incredible. He was used to weapons he'd made with crude arrows and fire-hardened points, and he was amazed at the difference. The bow was smooth and clean and quiet, and the arrows flew with a tight accuracy that at first he couldn't believe. On the first day, he had several shots where he actually hit one arrow with another in the center of the cardboard target. To protect his fingers, he used a simple leather tab that Blakely had thrown in, and he must have shot 200 times the first day. He didn't use sights, but shot by instinct. Let his mind and eye feel where the arrow would go as he'd done with his war bow in the woods, and within a week he could consistently hit a 6-inch circle in the cardboard from 20 yards. Just this one part of the list, the bow and arrows, took 2.5 weeks, not counting the time for shipping. The work gave him something to do, kept him active. Along with the list and practice, he had Caleb. 5 days a week he went to Caleb's house after school. His mother thought it was for counseling, though she wondered that no bills came. In a way, it was true. Counseling was a matter of telling somebody something and getting help with a problem, and that was what he was doing with Caleb. He told Caleb about his life in the woods, and though Caleb seldom said much, this talking helped Brian to understand himself and what was happening and what was going to happen to him. Caleb would make a pot of tea. Nothing fancy, just hot water and a tea bag with some cream and sugar, and have a cup waiting when Brian got there. Brian had never thought much of tea, but the first time he put sugar in it and sipped it while he spoke, it somehow seemed to always have been a part of him. It was so natural that after only a small bit of thought, he added tea to his list for the woods. Tea and sugar in cubes. He would take the tea, sit down in the iron chair, look at Caleb and say, "What do you want to hear about today?"
"I wouldn't even know what to ask. You pick it."
And Brian would think a moment and then tell a story of moose or fishing or the sun on the water or the way beaver build a house or the lonely cry of a loon in the night or the stomach-tightening wail of a wolf singing to the moon. And Caleb would listen quietly, his eyes staring off, sometimes crying or laughing, sometimes surprised, sometimes sad. Then there came a day when school was nearly done, when Brian had received nearly all the things on the list, and Caleb sighed and said,
"It's time for you to go back, to find what you're looking for."
Brian agreed. They'd spoken about his going back and how he had to know what it was that pulled him and made him feel empty. "But I don't know exactly how to do it," Brian said.
"I'll help you."
"You will?"
Caleb shrugged. "I'm supposed to be helping you recover your mental health, aren't I? Well, it's clear that for you to be mentally healthy, you have to go back to the woods and find what you left there."
"Well, that's true."
"What about that Cree family who rescued you, the trappers?"
"The Smallhorns." Brian thought of them often. "What about them?"
"Didn't they want you to come back and visit them?"
Brian stared. "Of course. It's perfect. Why didn't I think of that?" Chapter 7. It wasn't easy at first. He had expected difficulties with his parents, and he wasn't mistaken. His mother had a terrible fear of the bush, which had developed in the weeks when he had disappeared, and she had had to believe he was dead. They talked many nights before she relented. He was older now, more seasoned, and she knew that. He had done well the past summer when he had returned with Derek. With Caleb's help, his mother came around. "How will you find the Smallhorns?" she asked. "The pilot, the man who flew me out, will know where they are." Brian had kept the pilot's name. The man had a one-plane operation working out of International Falls on the Minnesota-Canada border, and Brian called.
"The Smallhorns? Yeah, they're up in the Williams Lake area in a fish camp. But I'm not due to go up there until fall. I'm booked solid all summer with fishing charters. I can't take the time to run you up there."
"Well, how about getting me close? I can make my own way in a canoe."
"Just a minute."
Brian heard papers shuffling as the pilot went through his records.
"Yeah, here. I'm due to take a couple of guys fishing in 10 days. We're going to the Granite Lake area, and with my fuel I can take you maybe another 100 miles. That's still 100 miles short of the Smallhorns camp, but it's all chain lakes up there, and you can do it without any really bad portages. I'll give you a good map. How heavy is your gear?"
"Maybe 200 pounds, plus me and the canoe."
"Can you haul a canoe?" "Sure, on the floats. We're taking one canoe, and I can fit yours on the other float. When are you figuring on coming out?"
"I'm not sure."
I'm due to make a supply run to them in the fall before trapping season and bad weather sets in. You could come out then.
Sure.
All right, you just fly up to International Falls and I'll meet you there.
He didn't exactly lie to his mother. He just didn't tell her the whole truth. She thought the plane was taking him all the way, and he didn't correct her. When he called to tell his father about his visit, he left the same impression, although he didn't think it would have mattered to his father that he planned to do the last 100 miles by canoe. His relationship with his father had also changed in the last year. They had grown somehow farther apart and closer at the same time. His father no longer seemed to think of him as a boy and didn't talk down to him. Now he spoke to Brian more as an equal.
"It sounds great," he said. "A long visit will do you good. You'll have a wonderful time."
The canoe was the problem. He had to pay extra for shipping it, and from Minneapolis north he had to send it by truck. The airlines took care of all the arrangements. He had to send it early for the canoe to be there when he arrived, and he worried that something would happen to it, hated to let it out of his sight. But the airline called to say when it arrived safely in International Falls, a full 4 days before he flew up himself. The rest of his gear he put in 2 backpacks, except for the bow and arrows. He checked the bow on the plane in a thick paper tube, and the arrows went in boxes with his packs. He did not take winter or cold weather gear, except for a windbreaker anorak and 2 polar fleece pullovers. He wasn't sure why. When he walked around the house or through town or was at school, there was not a thought in his mind of coming back. Perhaps he would, but as television had soured for him, he had started to read more, studied history more, and knew that in the past many young men his age, nearly 16, were away and into their lives. In the Civil War, 16-year-olds had been fighting, dying. With his parents' permission, Brian could enlist in the Army at 17. For better or worse, he was set on his own path, and he didn't think of coming back, and yet he didn't take winter gear. It was the lack of room, he told himself. He could get it later. He just didn't have enough room. The last 2 weeks were filled with calling the travel agent, assuring everybody he would be all right, making certain everything on the list was packed, and visiting Caleb. Then finally the last day came, and he visited Caleb to say goodbye.
"You're right," Caleb said. And it was not a question, but a statement. "I want to know how you're doing."
Brian nodded. "Except that I won't be able to get any mail out."
"In the fall. There'll be the supply run you told me about. You could send letters then."
"I will. I promise."
"Well then."
Brian stood and they started to shake hands. Then Caleb moved around the desk and grabbed him up in a bear hug. Brian's feet actually left the ground.
"All right," he promised when he was loose. "Tell me everything," Caleb said. "Tell me about light and colors, all of it."
"I will," he paused. "I don't know how to thank you."
Caleb smiled. "You already have. Just right."
His mother drove him to the airport and helped him with all his gear. At the check-in, she put her hand on one of the packs, and he looked at her, and she was crying. "I'll be fine, Mom." "I know. I just remember how it all started. The small plane and the hatchet I gave you, it all seemed so long ago, and it was just 2 years."
"No," Brian thought, hugging her. "It was more than that. It was a lifetime ago."
"You're grown now. Your father and I were talking about it last week. But when I see you like this, getting ready to leave, I think of you back then when you really were a little boy." She took a deep breath. "I don't want you to go." He didn't say anything because there was nothing to say. She was his mother, and he loved her. He loved his father, too. But he had to do this thing, or he would... He didn't know what he would do. Go crazy? Never be right? Somehow, inside, he would die. "I'll write and send it out by bush plane." "You'd better." She stayed with him at the gate, talking of small things and touching him now and again until it was time to board. And then she waved as he walked down the tunnel to the plane. Chapter 8. Brian flew to Minneapolis and changed to a shuttle flight to International Falls. He got in at 3 in the afternoon and found his canoe and paddles waiting at the airport. He called the bush pilot, who answered on the first ring, and told him to get his gear down to the dock by a store in Rainier, a little town on Rainy Lake near International Falls. Brian took a cab to the dock with all his gear. The driver had rope to tie the canoe to the rack on top of the car, said he did it all the time, what with all the people coming to the Boundary Waters canoe area. He waited on the end of the dock, and in an hour a bush plane with twin floats circled once, landed, and idled up to the dock. "Hi, Brian." The pilot jumped out and tied the plane to the dock. "Good to see you again. Just put your gear in the back seat and we'll tie your canoe on the float. Won't take a minute." In 5 minutes they were taxiing away from the dock. The pilot throttled back and moved down the lake a quarter mile to a small building beside another dock. "My shack," the pilot pointed with his chin. "I could have had you take the cab there, but the cabbies don't like the road. It's 2 miles through the woods and mostly mud. You got food?" Brian had been looking at the building. "Pardon? Do you have food with you? Thing is, the two fishermen are coming in early in the morning. I thought you'd stay here in the shack for the night while I go home, but there's no food here. I've got my jeep there, and we can run and get you something if you need it."
"I ate on the plane," Brian said, "and I have some stuff in the packs. I'll be fine."
"Good enough."
He pulled the plane delicately to the dock, climbed out on the float, and tied up the plane.
"We'll be back early in the morning. I plan on leaving here at daylight 30, about 4:30. See ya."
And he was gone.
Brian stood alone on the dock and looked at the shore. It was not woods. Not yet. Here and there were cabins and docks with boats next to them. But there were thick trees and bird sounds and green. Lord, he'd forgotten how thickly green the northern forest is in the summer. And he let the sounds and the lack of noise settle over him like a blanket. He stood there for perhaps 5 minutes, relaxing. It was coming into evening. He purposely had not brought a watch or clock. They did not fit where he would be. And he had been only partially honest with the pilot. He had eaten on the plane, a tiny sandwich and some peanuts and a Coke, but he didn't have food with him. Instead, he had the ability to get food. He took his pack with the sleeping bag out of the plane and moved up to the small building. It was unlocked, and inside it was full of old engine parts and fishing gear. There was a couch in one corner, and he thought of sleeping on it. But the sky didn't look like rain, and the stink from paint cans in the corner convinced him. He would sleep away from the shack. In one pocket of the pack he had rolls of fishing line, small sinkers, and a plastic container of hooks. He had seen many small panfish, bluegills, and sunfish by the dock when he stepped off the plane float, and he rigged a line with a hook and sinker. Then he went into the trees, turned over a rotting log, and grabbed half a dozen earthworms. The fish seemed starved, and in 10 minutes he'd caught 5 of them. He pulled the line, rolled it on a stick, and put it back in his pack. Then he cleaned the fish, leaving the heads on, scaled them with the back of his knife, and threw them in his smaller pot. The shore was covered with driftwood, and in moments he had a small cooking fire going near the water's edge on the small strip of sand beach. He added lake water to the pot, slapped the lid on, and put it directly into the flames. The evening crop of mosquitoes found him, but he threw some green grass and leaves on the fire. The smoke drove them away. He sat and watched the evening sun disappear over the lake to his left and thought how truly and honestly right it felt. Once, when he didn't think he could stand being at home any longer, in the middle of the night he had taken the blanket off his bed and gone into the backyard and lain on the ground. It was almost more than he could bear to be in a room without an open window. He had to feel the air on his skin, to feel a part of the outside. That night he had lain trying to see up to the sky, to the stars. There was too much city light to see much, but he tried, just as he tried to pretend the air in the yard was the same as the air in the woods. Now he spread his bag in the grass on the bank and lay on it. It was not dark yet, but close, and he could make out an evening star, and he thought of how people wished on them. He had never done it, but now he wished he could see it again the next night, and the next, and the next, and always be able to see it. He smelled his fish soup. It was nearly done, and he added a couple of pinches of salt from a plastic bag he had brought and set the pot off the fire to cool a little. After 10 minutes he took the lid off and used the tip of his knife and a spoon to peel the skin away, then ate the tender pink meat along the backbones.
He ate quickly, carefully avoiding the bones, and then drank the broth. He cleaned his pan in the lake and decided to put up his tent to avoid the night bugs. He'd brought a small two-man tent. He'd thought of going without one at first, but the tent was very light and had screened openings, and the insects, whether he loved the woods or not, were awful. It took him 5 minutes to set it up and put his bag inside, but instead of going to bed at once, he put more driftwood on the fire and sat for a while in the dark. He was close now. Not quite there, but very close. Tomorrow the plane would take him northeast. He smiled. He unzipped the tent and crawled inside and lay on top of the bag. For the first time in months, he was sound asleep within 5 minutes. Chapter 9. Brian awakened and for a second did not remember where he was. There was a scuffling outside and he thought of Bear and how stupid he'd been to leave his pack on the ground next to the tent. When he looked out, he saw not a bear, but a skunk, and it wasn't near his pack, but smelling around the dead embers of the fire. The fish leftovers. When he'd finished the soup, he'd put the skins and heads and bones on the fire and burned them. The smell must have traveled up and down the lake shore. There was half a moon and enough light to make out what was happening. He sat up to watch, and the movement startled the skunk, which immediately raised its tail and aimed at him, from 6 feet away, but held fire. Brian sat very still, and the skunk seemed to shrug, and then lowered its tail and went back to snooping around the fire. When it didn't find anything, it looked once more at the screened tent, snorted, and waddled off into the night. Brian smiled as he watched it leave. He didn't know if it was a female, but thought of it that way because the only other skunk he'd known closely had been a female that had adopted him and moved in with him when he'd spent the winter in the north. She had saved him from a bear, and he would always have a soft spot for skunks. In the east, the sky was faintly light, and Brian decided to get up and get ready. The pilot had said daylight 30, and that would be in not much over an hour. He made a small fire and put some water on to boil and dropped a pinch of tea in the water. While it was heating and boiling, he rolled his bag and took the tent down and repacked it. For a time he had nothing to do, and he sat watching the fire, feeling hunger come back. The fish and broth had filled him, but hadn't lasted long, and he didn't have time now to fish and cook before it was time to leave. Hunger was an old friend. Once it had been an enemy, and he had panicked whenever he felt the edges of it. But now he knew he wouldn't die if he didn't eat right away, or even this day, and he mentally tightened his belt. Besides, he had some sugar cubes. He put 3 of them in the tea and drank it out of the pot as soon as it had cooled enough and the hunger was knocked down. He used the empty pot to pour water on the fire, killed it completely, and stirred the ashes into slush. Then he loaded his pack and sleeping bag back on the plane and sat on the dock, waiting. Somewhere nearby, a loon called for the morning, the sound flowing gently across the lake, and it seemed then, for a moment, as if he'd never been gone, as if the past 2 years and more had not existed and he'd stayed in the bush. This lasted until he heard a motor and looked up to see an old Jeep Cherokee rattling down the ruts to the shack. There was a canoe on top, and the pilot and 2 men inside. Brian stood and waited as the Jeep parked. The 3 of them got out and took the canoe down and moved onto the dock. He'd been dreading meeting the fishermen. All the magazines he'd read and some of the shows he'd watched on television had left a bad taste in his mouth about so-called professional fishermen. He didn't feel like explaining himself to anybody. The pilot knew who he was, knew the Smallhorns, and that he was going to visit them, or assumed it. Now there were 2 others who had asked questions. But Brian was wrong. The men were old, past 60, but still moving well. They took the canoe down and tied it on the off float of the plane, the one away from the dock, with practiced ease. They looked so much alike that Brian thought they must be brothers, square-jawed and balding. What hair they had was gray and bristly. They smiled easily, said hello to Brian, but didn't ask more from him. The plane was almost full by the time the men got their gear behind the rear seat. Brian moved his packs back as well and slid into the rear seat. The plane only took 4 adults, so 1 of the old men sat next to him, and oddly enough, it was Brian who wanted to question them. Their fishing equipment wasn't new or high-tech, The reels were old casting reels, obviously well kept, and the men handled them with an almost loving care. Brian was silent until they were in the air, and then he turned to the man next to him. "Do you fish a lot?" The man had been looking out the window, down at the lakes, and he turned and smiled.
"Once a year. We go up into the bush lakes and fish for